These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit. Stand up.
From WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service and NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, we will explore the current conditions in Ethiopia. Africa World Now Project is next. Freedom Dreams, The Black Radical Imagination. Robin D.G. Kelly writes that most black people believe there was an order higher than the Constitution. Throughout the Africana experience in the Americas, Psalms 68, verse 31 of the Bible promised redemption for the black world. It reads, "Princes shall come out of Egypt. Ethiopia shall soon stretch forth her hands unto God." This passage was as important to the Pan-Africanist and immigrationist sentiment as the Book of Exodus, even becoming the theological and ideological basis for what became known in the 19th century as Ethiopianism. Ethiopianism spread throughout the black world, from the Americas to the continent of Africa, calling for the redemption of Africa by any means necessary. One of the earliest published examples of this doctrine was Robert Alexander Young's Ethiopian Manifesto, issued in defense of the black man's rights and the scale of universal freedom, which predicted the coming of a new Hannibal who would lead a violent uprising to liberate the race. The black radical abolitionist Maria Stewart echoed some of the ideas in Young's manifesto, drawing on biblical scripture to argue that Africans were indeed the chosen people. While she identified herself as African, she described America as the great city of Babylon and believed that black people possessed a distinct national identity. Up to that historical point, Ethiopia, in the radical imagination of most African descendants, had been predestined by biblical prophecy to redeem the black race from white rule. Just like Haiti represented a revolutionary David to the French Goliath, Ethiopia's reputation as a beacon of hope and strength for the Africana world strengthened in 1896 after the defeat of Italy at the Battle of Adwa. To the Africana world, this was yet another sign that Europe was indeed vulnerable, and it rendered Africa's, quote, holy land, unquote, the only independent nation state on the continent at the time. Of course, every reality is more complicated. Menelik II, from a southern Ethiopian province, indeed united many local rulers, but he also forcefully consolidated his power over his new allies and signed a treaty with Italy in an effort to undermine the rule of Emperor Jonas IV, who ruled from the north. This treaty ceded Eritrean territory to Italy in exchange for money and weapons. While some scholars praise Abyssinia for its ancient civilization, its written language, its rulers' proud claim of direct lineage to Solomon and the Queen of Sheba, other black radical writers and thinkers showed more skepticism. On the eve of Mussolini's invasion, Ethiopia was ruled by a dying monarchy that did not believe in land reform and was one of the few regions on earth where slavery persisted well into the 1930s. Ethiopia at the time was hardly a land of freedom. Preceding David Walker's 1829 appeal by 6 months, Robert Alexander Young's Ethiopian Manifesto, issued in defense of the black man's rights in the scale of universal freedom, called for the unity on the part of the worldwide Pan-African community. Young reminded the, quote, Ethiopians, unquote, that in every nation, including those of Africa, they shared commonalities and continuities. Although the term African diaspora is of very relatively recent genealogy, taking full academic formation during the 1960s, Africana writers and thinkers have called attention to the dispersal of African peoples since the early 1900s, and it is in Robert Alexander Young's Ethiopian Manifesto in which he recognized the universal oppression of African peoples that place him among one of the first to call for the convocation of ourselves in a body politic. In other words, to unite as an African people worldwide. In the manifesto, Young compares the slave labor of the Negroes in the American southern states to the captivity of the people of Israel in Egypt. He calls all Africans in captivity Ethiopians and predicts that a black Messiah will come to deliver the people. The histories of African American and Ethiopia interacting is both deep and complex. But what is clear? Ethiopia held its own space in the sociopolitical thought of the Africana world that fueled the range of resistance from Back to Africa movements to Rastafari communities around the world. Ethiopia was the Zion of Africa in the minds of peoples around the Africana world. In his New World A Coming, Roy Otley wrote that Negroes first became aware of the black nation of Ethiopia back in 1919 when Ethiopian dignitaries arrived in the United States on a diplomatic mission. During their stay in New York, this group received a delegation of black folk from Harlem. During a ceremonial reception for this diplomatic mission held at the Metropolitan Baptist Church in Harlem, and before departing the United States, the mayor of Addis Ababa, who was with the delegation, delivered a speech expressing Ethiopian and Afro-American unity. For the 100 or so Afro-Americans reported living in Ethiopia in 1933, undoubtedly the vast majority had responded to various official invitations and appeals recruiting technically skilled black Americans to settle in the country. These invitations urged black folk to settle in Ethiopia, specifically encouraging the migration of farmers, mechanics, engineers, physicians, dentists, and scientists in an attempt to modernize the ancient empire. Haile Selassie offered them free land and high wages. Throughout the 1900s, African descendants from the U.S. did go to Ethiopia. Dr. John West of Washington, D.C. was appointed the emperor's personal physician in 1930. Universal sympathy expressed by Afro-Americans for the Ethiopian-Italian War was shaped into concrete reality through the activities of several war relief committees. Committees were organized in New York, Chicago, Kansas City, and other principal cities. Actual participation in the war was expressed through the military activities of two Afro-American airmen, Colonel John Charles Robinson of Chicago and Trinidadian-born Colonel Herbert Fauntleroy Julian, who arrived in Ethiopia in late 1934 as volunteer pilots for the only two Ethiopian planes that were airworthy during the war. The few volunteer European pilots in the war only flew mercy missions, bringing medical supplies and the wounded, while Robinson and Julian provided the principal air defense of Ethiopia. While Julian conspired with Italians to embezzle government funds, you always have one of these in the pack, Robinson, yielding to the personal persuasion of the emperor's son, the late Duke of Hara, remained in Ethiopia to establish commercial air service into East Africa and the Sudan. With the purchase of an old World War II DC-3 aircraft, Robinson became service crew and pilot for the forerunner of the present Ethiopian Airlines. I wanted to give a brief overview, because there's much more here, and contextualize the deep historical context of U.S. African-descended connections and continuities with Ethiopia, in an effort to prime your historical memory of the importance of Ethiopia in the context of Africana internationalism and its place in the black radical imagination as a platform to understanding the current conditions in the nation. More importantly, why Africa, its nations, and the conditions within which communities face there are directly related to the conditions within which Africana peoples face across the world, and why Alpheus Huntington of the 1942-1955 Council on African Affairs, W.E.B. Du Bois, Claudia Jones, Maria Stewart, Anna Julia Cooper, Paul Robeson, El Hajj Malik El Shabazz, John Henry Clark, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and many others understood at a fundamental level a free Africa meant a free Africana world. Today, Africa World Now Project's Moisa Mutale speaks with Ayantu Ayana, doctoral student and member of the Oromo Advocacy Alliance, where she contextualizes the current conditions in Ethiopia. Ayantu Ayana addresses the underlying historically rooted issues that manifest today in the country. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descended communities of Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Enjoy the program. We'll be right back.
Sandra Ayana, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for taking the time to be with us. And I want us to start to discuss the killing assassination of Hachalu Hundessa. If you could expand on, we'll start talking about his career as well and the role he played in the Oromo community.
Okay. Yeah, well, Hachalu Hundessa was assassinated on June 29th in Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia. He was an Oromo musician, musician and an activist. He really was a beloved figure who stood for justice. He fought for the masses of Oromo farmers, producers who are not heard in, you know, and who are silenced within the Ethiopian conversation. And he fiercely protected them, the culture, what they represent, and the lands that they were protecting from misuse. He was the voice of a whole generation. He was part of this Oromo protest movement that really was about getting more self-administration for people in Ethiopia who've been, you know, oppressed by the state, who've been left without authentic representation. And he really gave voice to these aspirations, and he amplified that collective voice of the Oromo youth of his generation and the generational struggle of the Oromo.
And because of him, he and others who were part of that movement led to the current president to be in power, right, in 2018, Abiy Ahmed.
That's correct. The Oromo protests had been going on since 2014. And people, you know, Oromo youth and other sectors of Oromo society were on the street protesting what had become very unlivable conditions. Oromo farmers were losing land en masse, and there was, you know, there was a criminalization of Oromo identity and anybody who spoke against that kind of dispossession. And so this protest made it, you know, it was the catalyst for a shakeup within the then ruling party, the EPRDF. The prime minister resigned and Abiy stepped in. He was elected in by that party, not by the population. And the idea was that he was to lead the country towards free and fair elections so that people may express these grievances and be heard.
They wanted to also expand a bit more on the land dispossession, because one of the things that was at the center of what he was discussing was the loss of land in around the capital city, Addis Ababa, which is in the Oromo area. And there was this mega project that they wanted to expand the city, and they took over some of the lands from farmers, as well as the other land grab issues that have taken place in Ethiopia in the recent times. If you can expand a bit on that as well. Who are some of the players in that?
Well, you know, this is really a problem that has affected a majority of Ethiopia's people since they were incorporated into the state by Menelik through conquest at the end of the 19th century. The state has, you know, it's changed in different forms, but one thing that hasn't changed is the control over these lands that belong to communities. And there, under EPRDF, there was such a huge dispossession, you know, more than 700,000 households in the surrounding areas of Addis Ababa alone lost their lands. So what happens when this many people lose their lands? Well, they flood to the city. And in the city, what do they find? If they're lucky, they might find some low-wage jobs. But otherwise, they're just in very, you know, horrible living conditions. At the same time, these cities are culturally exclusionary to the Oromo. They're exclusionary of the language. So when people lose this land, they're not just losing the land. Loss of land is also loss of identity. It's loss of cultural resources, and it's loss of ancient ideas and pr- practices of taking care of the land, taking care of people, taking care of all living beings.
And we're talking to Ayantu Ayana, who's a doctoral student and also a member of the Oromo Advocacy Alliance. We're looking at the Ethiopian situation, the context behind the crisis in Ethiopia presently. And if the, as you said, the disenfranchisement affected the community in general, and of course, as we're talking about how the protest that led to the shakeup of the EPRDF, which is the ruling party at that time, the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, which led to Abiy Ahmed coming to power, who was himself an Oromo. And people expected a lot of changes. And one of the things that Hachalu Hundessa was speaking about was some of the kind of backtracking of the reforms that were supposed to be put in place. If we could elaborate a bit on that as well, and how, what are some of the things that which we people expected that didn't come to fruition that at this present time?
So, you know, after a long history of, you know, military centralization, in 1995, Ethiopia adopted a constitution. It was supposed to establish a multinational federal system through which these previously sovereign people who had been stripped of their capacity to administer their own affairs could begin exercising some control over their land, over how it's used. And when the protests were precisely about that, it was partly about the fact that this multinational federalism was being prevented from working by the kind of monopoly that the TPLF and the EPRDF in general exercised. And so when Abiy came to power, the protesters were all told, give him some time, your demands for greater self-administration, greater access to resources and language and opportunities, and the use of the Afaan Oromo language, which is spoken by over 40 million people at the federal level, which people demanded should be one of the federal languages, which still wasn't. Ethiopia still only has Amharic as its working federal language, and that has been one of the ongoing contentions. The other thing was about the fate of Addis Ababa. The Oromo, the Tulama Oromo there, they still live surrounding it. And the elite's dream of constantly expanding this capital threatens their livelihoods, it threatens their culture, it threatens their identity. And so people were wanting this city to be demarcated so that the rights of Oromia over this territory could be clear, the rights of the federal government could be clear. So all of these demands were essentially ignored. So Abiy did the exact opposite of what protesters had been expecting, which was he dismantled the EPRDF, and then he created a single national party, which goes completely against the spirit of multinational federalism. He adapted as well this language of empire that privileges the state and historically powerful elites, which make up less than 20% of Ethiopia's population, at the expense of this dominated mass of people who've been resisting and fighting and waiting for a real change that they could benefit from. Abiy was taking all the steps away from the demands of the protesters. And that's when he began losing support, even though he had a lot of goodwill in the very beginning.
Yeah, and as you said, he had a lot of goodwill, and he only came to power in 2018 and lost support. And I was wondering if you'd also expand a bit more on the issue you mentioned, which is the federalism and how it was based on the ethno-linguistic lines, but also backtrack a bit so that we can I wanted to do kind of expand so that we can really have a full understanding of the history, because there's always the misunderstanding of the complexity of Ethiopia and the various groups within the country, because it was an empire. And if we could expand a bit more on how that has always been an undercurrent issue of what is an Ethiopian.
Well, you know, I think one thing that's definitely not appreciated enough by people who are not from Ethiopia, and some who are, is that a lot of the issues that we're facing today, the political issues, you know, the economic issues, the cultural issues, emanate from this, you know, conquest at the end of the 19th century, which Menelik II brought all of these previously sovereign peoples together into one state. And thereafter, these groups lost a say over their own affairs, over things that affect them. And groups such as the Tulama Oromo, who lived in what is now Addis Ababa, which they called Shagar or Finfinne, groups such as the Gulele, such as the Eka, the Abiyu, they were completely, pushed out of, they were massacred and they were pushed out of physically that area to make the seat of Addis Ababa for this expanding empire. And so this seat, you know, like Addis Ababa is very contentious because this was the seat of the Abba Muda, which was the supreme spiritual leader of the Oromo. This was the ritual center. And so there's a lot of very historical component to the struggle. And this conquest, you know, which the Oromo have always referred to as Gabrumma, was fiercely resisted. The RC Oromo themselves fought fiercely from 1880 to 1886 against Menelik's army. And they were massacred, but they really resisted. And even after conquest, they, you know, these people, not just the RC, but also the Harerge Oromo, but also other groups, really resisted complete annihilation. You know, when after the empire conquered them, it tried to destroy them, destroy their identity, destroy their connection to the land. But they did stay. They're alive. They're resisting. They're still trying to assert some control over how their future unfolds. And so when, you know, there is no one Ethiopian identity in the sense that people think about. There is different peoples in Ethiopia who come at this identity from different positionalities, from different historical memories, and from different experiences. And often what is projected onto the outside world as Ethiopian identity is Abyssinian culture, language, like Orthodox Christianity, Amharic, this myth of the Solomonic dynasty, and the, you know, the genius of the Ge'ez script and so on. This is the master narrative of Ethiopia. It is one story, but it is often presented as the whole story and the only story. And I think that's a huge injustice, because it silences all the other voices that are wanting to be heard in this space.
Yeah, I'm glad you also raised the issue of the Christianity issue, because people forget that Ethiopia has a huge Muslim community as well. If you can elaborate on that as well.
That's right. I mean, there's a big number of Muslims, and they've always been there. They've been there for almost for as long as Christianity has been there. There's also groups who still hold on to their indigenous spiritual religious traditions. Often the people who are conquered did take on Christianity, did take on Islam, but they also incorporated their own indigenous spiritual beliefs and practices into it. So there's a lot of indigenization that goes on at the local level, at the communal level, for many of these peoples.
And we're talking about the Ethiopia, looking at the crisis in the context in Ethiopia with Ayatu Ayana. who's a doctoral student and a member of the Oromo Advocacy Alliance. And I wanted to ask if we can go back to, so we'll go back to the assassination of Achalu Hadesa. And one, so this, as we're looking at that assassination and then his role in the movement as well, raising the issues of the Oromo people and how that has led, of course, to this massive demonstrations. And if you could expand also a bit on that aspect, the movement as we are talking, and how, where are the leadership now? Because a lot of them have been, there's been a big clamp down, and people, a lot of people have been arrested. Is it, where is the mass movement going now at this present time and in these conditions?
Well, yes, a lot of the individuals such as Jawar Mohammed, Bakala Garba, and many leaders of the Oromo Federalist Congress, the Oromo Liberation Front, and other legally registered parties have been arrested. They were arrested almost immediately, the very next day after Hachalu's assassination was announced. There has, you know, the government also closed the Oromia Media Network, which was one of the few non-governmental alternatives to the government-controlled media landscape. There's been a very serious crackdown against activists, organizers, journalists, business people, elders, basically anyone who supports federalism, who supports or is connected with this Oromo protest grassroots movement. What we are seeing is not new. Because this happens almost at every potential transitional period in Ethiopian history, where any time a strong voice builds around rearranging the state to address historical grievances, to give people who've been oppressed a voice, to create a more just state. We see the states more authoritarian, more conservative. You know, we see the empire impulse bubbling to the front, and the empire impulse is militarization, it is criminalization, it is mass arrest. 7,000 people have been arrested in the last 3 weeks alone. They're arresting so many people that they are making makeshift schools into jails. And this is happening in a global pandemic, you know, putting all of these people at risk and also putting their families at risk, because whenever people are released, they're going back into, you know, communities and into their families. So right now we are seeing a very strong and impulsive empire desire to squash what it sees as a threat to its existence. But my argument is that the Oromo protests are not a threat to Ethiopia. In fact, I think the Oromo protests are an answer to this historic and ongoing crisis that we find ourselves in. I think if the aspirations of the Oromo and other oppressed groups in Ethiopia are realized, I think it would create an Ethiopia that is at peace with itself, and an Ethiopia that doesn't need to constantly militarize, constantly kill people, constantly imprison its people.
And I wanted to quote also from the Amnesty International. They issued a report on the 18th of July 2020, just a few days ago. And it said in Addis Ababa and Oromia, the police have arrested at least 5,000 people, many of whom are in incommunicado detention with their whereabouts unknown. And as you discuss as you're talking to various folks within the country, has there been any information of some of the people's whereabouts? I know some people have been found, but are they most of the people incommunicado, or is there also a large number of people that you can know where they are, where their arrests are?
I think it's a little bit of both. There are some people, like for instance, three of my friends. Mm-hmm.
We are currently listening to Africa Walt Nell Project's Moisa Mutale speaking with Ayantu Ayana, doctoral student and member of the Oromo Advocacy Alliance, where she is contextualizing the current conditions in Ethiopia. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descended communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places we're fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Continue to enjoy the program.
I think it's a little bit of both. There are some people, like for instance, three of my friends are now in jails, and many other people that I know. A couple of them are U.S. citizens, so the embassy there has been able to learn about their whereabouts, but not their families. I think for the vast majority of people, it's very, you know, when you mass arrest this many people, you are channeling them into all kinds of makeshift detention centers. And in some cases, you know, unofficial, really dangerous detention centers where people can be disappeared. And disappearances are not new in Ethiopia, which is why I think families are really terrified. It's that, you know, people, there's still people missing from the 80s. From the 90s, from the 70s. So this way of trying to get rid of dissent is very dangerous, and a lot of families are very worried because they, you know, there is nobody that you can really hold accountable. You go to the jail and you want to see your beloved, and somebody there at the jail will say they're not here. And what do you do? Who do you report the police to?
So it's interesting you mentioned that this situation is not necessarily new, and also that the government has gone back to the reaction of how the Empire State would have reacted, or other governments in the past would have reacted. And how, as I've seen a couple of statements from the head of state, the head of government, Abiy Ahmed. And how has his reaction been, considering what is going on, and how? Of course, you mentioned earlier that he's lost a lot of credibility within the society.
I think Abiy is a very interesting case because he comes from the security services of the state. As I said earlier, he was part of the previous ruling party. So this is not somebody who is coming from the outside. This is somebody who has been a soldier. This is somebody who grew up within this very authoritarian, top-down kind of political and military culture. Two weeks ago, he came out on state TV and he said, "Nothing or no one comes above Ethiopia. Nothing or no one is above Ethiopia. It doesn't really matter what the death toll, it doesn't really matter what the cost, Ethiopia shall prevail." And this kind of discourse, you know, is not a new discourse. It's troubling, but it's an old discourse. And this is basically what the Derg, you know, leader, Mengistu Haile Mariam, used to say, you know, Ethiopia take them. And it's this ideology that the Empire State shall come above all, and anybody who threatens that order, which is the economic, historical, and political privilege of a very small number of elites over this vast country. So he is completely removed from the grassroots movement. He is also completely removed from the historical grievances that different generations have been battling with and that have been championing. He is someone who was only able to receive credibility among the youth initially because he made allies with others, people like Jawar Mohammed, others within Ethiopia, who really begged this grassroots movement and the youth to give Abiy, who was an unknown entity until then, to give him a chance about 2 years ago. And so, you know, even starting out, people didn't really know him. They didn't know what he's about. He seemed to hear the youth initially, and then completely ignored them, and not just ignored them, but his party, the state media, have gone on a rampage calling the Oromo protesters savages, mob killers, and just like this really dehumanizing rhetoric that's meant to delegitimize them and make their eventual elimination a necessity to maintain law and order in Ethiopia.
And also one of the things that I heard him say was that their work of a foreign agent, he didn't say quite government, but he said just a foreigners. If you could expand on that and how, whether that's anywhere accurate or just a way of just trying to, as you said, delegitimize their movement.
This is not anything new. When the EPRDF was really challenged by the protest movements, one of their go-to statements was that this was the work of an external force or agent that's trying to destabilize the empire. It's a very historical kind of go-to for consecutive governments. It's a way of not addressing that there are legitimate domestic demands, there are legitimate historical grievances, contemporary grievances, people have demands, they've been mobilizing for these demands, they've been ignored, and people are still angry, and they're still, for the most part, peacefully resisting the kind of oppression to which they've been subjected. I think when a government is not prepared or is not willing, just lacks the political will to address what's happening within its borders, it makes up these excuses and points fingers outwards. But I think the key to solving the Ethiopian crisis is fundamentally inside. Abiy needs to look inside, and he needs to look historically.
And speaking about looking inside, one of the things that happened as soon as he took over, there was a truth commission that was set up. What happened to that process?
Well, when the prime minister came in, he unilaterally set up all of these different commissions, and one of them was this. And it was just something in name. There was on paper, the names of these people who were to be on this commission was announced, but it never really went anywhere there, because this Abiy's government didn't really have the will to address the kind of authoritarian political culture that has been there since conquest, and to address these fundamental demands and contradictions within Ethiopian society that have been there and that continue to be there generations after generations. And so he created these commissions, but nothing ever happened to them. The prime minister has been busy building vanity projects, for instance, memorializing Menelik, who's a very controversial figure and really most hated in the conquered regions, because a lot of people rightly hold him responsible for destroying these ancient African cultures in the name of building this empire. And the prime minister, his rhetoric, the fact that he has created a unitary party, he's headed in the direction that a lot of Ethiopians understand what its implications are. When you try to create a unitary sort of system in a country like Ethiopia that has had the kinds of historical problems it has had, people feel like this is an existential threat to their way of life, to their land, to their capacity to have a voice at all in what goes on in Ethiopia. So his actions have really produced a lot of resistance. And I think the media, especially the Western media, has lost sight of where Abiy has gone wrong. They report that Abiy is a unifying figure who has eschewed ethnicity in favor of a national identity. Well, what is a national identity that excludes majority of Ethiopians from the culture, from the economics, from the politics? It's not so national. What he's doing is legitimization of empire narratives, empire rhetorics that privilege Abyssinian culture and history and memories while ignoring the subjugated majority who are still holding on to their culture, who have much to contribute to this country, who are wanting to be heard.
And if we could expand a bit more also on Menelik, because I think one of the songs that Hachalu Hendessa sang about was about that, right?
Yes, Hachalu was, you know, one of the things that really make Hachalu brilliant, absolutely brilliant, is that he is someone who comes from an Oromo community and family that's very connected to the land, that's very connected to ancient knowledge and ways of life and worldviews and history. He himself comes from the Tulama Oromo, whose land was taken to make these, you know, garrison towns that are now cities. And so he really taps into what are the memories of the Oromo mass about this empire. And this is what he puts in his music. In his very last interview with the Oromia Media Network, he said that, you know, Menelik arrived in the Oromo land on a donkey, and then he proceeded to steal the horse of a brilliant Oromo horseman who loved this horse, who took care of this horse. And this, what Hachalu said really angered a lot of people, because it shows that the people who were conquered by Menelik reject his legacy. They reject the narratives of the empire. They have their own stories and they have their own viewpoints. And so, you know, Menelik is a very controversial figure, and Hachalu wasn't one to go on and on about empire. His focus really was on the stories, on the lives, on the identities that the empire silences, that the empire tries to annihilate and completely remove from view. After all, how is it that there is almost 40 million Oromos, but they remain largely invisible to other Africans?
So he was, as we were just discussing all along today, he was really making context, proper context of putting the historical in the present.
That's correct, yes.
So, because one of the things that, especially when we're discussing the federalism of the country, and how you started talking about that earlier, about how this was based on ethnic linguistic lines, and if we could expand a bit on how, of course, you have said that one reason why it has not really worked, that process hasn't worked, but if it expand a bit further on how it hasn't really manifested itself for the local population, particularly when you look at the what has happened in the present time as well, and connecting it to the historical context.
Right. So in the 1950s, there was this Oromo decolonial leader called Wak Ogutu, and there was this line that he really liked to say that shows, you know, what the Oromo approach has been to this system of oppression. He said, Gabruma hiddan bukifna yo datdabne ilma itiguddifna. And it basically, it means, it translates to, if we can, we shall uproot this colonial system. And if we cannot, we shall raise children who will carry on that fight. And that's exactly what the Oromo and other groups have done. The multinational federal system that was established in 1995 was meant to help this empire loosen up its colonial arrangements. A lot of groups wanted outright independence from Ethiopia, but they settled on a negotiated multinational federalism so that Ethiopia can stay together, but these various groups can still have a say over their culture and their resources and their capacity to develop themselves. So the Oromo wanted a federal system that allows them that, you know, that say over land and natural resources, so that their land is not just exploited by elites who are in Addis Ababa or by elites controlled from Addis Ababa. The Oromo concept of Ababi Yuma, for instance, speaks to being a good custodian of the land and keeping it from environmentally and socially harmful practices. It is similar to this Native American concept of taking care of the land for seven generations. So there's a lot of, you know, the Oromo really want that custodianship over the land. And this is one of the major issues of the Oromo protests. They also want a federal system that allows them regionally to continue to exist and develop their culture, their language, and worldviews. You know, today, Oromo history is not taught as an essential part of Ethiopian history. The Oromo appear in the historiography as threats to Ethiopia, as people who are newcomers, as people who have nothing to contribute. So really harmful beliefs and values and ideas are transmitted from generation to generation. And the Oromo would like to have a say over what the children are learning, that they learn about the Oromo institutions, the African institutions, such as the Gada and the Sike, through which many groups governed themselves egalitarianly. And they want also a political system that makes room for their ancient governance principles and philosophies, you know, so that there is a robust political culture that encourages cooperation, the collective good, ethics, and balance between different sources of power. So these are, you know, the Oromo are demanding a more robust federalism, a decentralized federalism that allows them from the small levels at the villages to the very top, that they get to select who governs them. Leaders who are accountable to the people, not to whoever is sitting in 4 Kilo in Addis Ababa. So in that sense, these Oromo demands are similar to the demands that other African people who are still existing in states that are for the most part, stuck in colonial legacies.
And you say that these demands are also the same as other groups within the country, because of course Oromos are the biggest ethnic group, but then there are many others. And would this be the same aspirations for the other groups as well, who feel marginalized from the system?
Yes, absolutely. There are now 10 states within the federal, there are 10 regional states within the federal system in Ethiopia. I've been talking about the Oromo so far because of the ongoing Oromo protests and because of where they are within Ethiopia, they're kind of in the center. Addis Ababa, you know, is Oromo land. It's historically where Oromos were when Menelik came and displaced those groups I talked about earlier. But yes, the Sidama demands are the same. The Somali demands are the same. And this, you know, the 1995 constitution was a recognition of the existence of all of these different sovereign peoples who were wanting to have more say, more space. And the constitution starts with, "We the people, we the nations, nationalities, and peoples of Ethiopia." So it's not just the Oromo. These are very, very widespread demands and very widespread desire for federalism for decentered federalism to operate in Ethiopia as it was intended to. So majority of Ethiopians, in essence, want to improve on the federal promises of the 1995 constitution. What Abiy and other historically powerful elites are doing is to chip away at this system, to chip away at the small gains that historically oppressed people have made until we are back to the centralized empire state. And then people will have to again wage a whole other struggle against it to assert their own sovereignty.
I'm glad you also mentioned that, you put Abiy and also elites, and expanding on that, do you see also politicians using the ethnicity as a way to mobilize people, and if so, to what extent has that been a negative force as well?
You know, the problem of the elites is the problem of the elites everywhere, isn't it? There is this very genuine grassroots transgenerational struggle by the Oromo and the Sidama and other groups in Ethiopia to realize freedom, to realize a new arrangement. And of course, there are elites. And of course, elites, some of them exploit this. For instance, Abiy exploited the Oromo protests. He appeared on the scene and he was, he came to power essentially because of this grassroots demands. And then he turned his back on those grassroots demands. So elite betrayal is a very real thing and it exists.
Yeah. So, and I was wondering if, do you see some of the parties, how, to what extent, because some people have said that with the unbanning of the parties, that has led to the ethnic tensions, and I was wondering to what extent is that true? And gathering from the historical analysis, I don't think that's probably the full reason why there's these tensions as well.
Right. So what we have is two things. One is we have historically powerful elites, people who governed this empire. You see, these are people, these are Abyssinians, but these are also elites from the conquered territories. So together they make up a fraction of the 20% of the urban population. Majority of Ethiopians live in the rural areas. And so this majority group wants to use its own resources, develop its land, develop its culture, continue to exist as a people, as I said earlier. But this elite, what they want is a centralized state through which they can control the resources of the dominated majority and to silence these voices. And so Abiy is one such party, and one of the things that they're doing is to put forth this narrative, especially in Western media, that the problem in Ethiopia is ethnic tensions, that somehow there's too much tribalism and so on. It's a very convenient way to ignore these historic and contemporary demands. It's a way of to silence a dominated majority for the most part remains invisible in the global imagination of Ethiopia. So we see, we see kind of how this is playing out. I've been observing the way that there is a kind of positioning of Jawar Mohammed, for instance, who is an Oromo nationalist, and then positioning him versus Abiy, who is somebody interested very much in empire. And so the entire, narrative of what's going on in Ethiopia gets boiled down to Jawar Mohammed, man, ethno-nationalist, Abiy Ahmed, man, Ethiopian nationalist, which is a serious oversimplification, as you can imagine. And the voices of the majority of Ethiopians are silenced by it.
Yeah, no, it's very much so. It makes it up. And then also it reduces it to as if it's a personality issue,
yes.
Like it's just a one individual instead of looking at the systemic issues. And I think that's one thing that you see with Abiy Ahmed is that he has the charisma. And so everyone is looking at him, and he's been given the Nobel Peace Prize, reaching out to Eritrea. And actually talking about reaching out to Eritrea, if we could expand a bit as well on that aspect as well. What role does that play into the Ethiopian political landscape, that reaching out to Eritrea?
Yeah, let me just say first that those of us who've been observing Ethiopia really believe that the Nobel Prize, the real recipients of the Nobel Prize should have been the grassroots movement, the Oromo protesters, elsewhere who are calling for peace, because peace realized in Ethiopia is very helpful in peace realized in the region, including in Eritrea. However, you're right. I think when it comes to Africa, there is a desire to the Western imagination seeks for one individual it can capture, or that can capture their imagination and that they can kind of use as a parameter for what else is going on. And I think Abiy has been that. He does appear charismatic, he does appear youthful, he does appear open-minded and all of that. But the fact that he's imprisoning 7,000 people in 3 weeks, I think is making people take a second look. did we make a mistake here? And I think the whole thing with Eritrea and Ethiopia has been such a mess because Abiy and the Eritrean president keep meeting, but nothing has come of it officially. There's no document. The process is not transparent. And a lot of Eritrean activists have said that this is for so long, Eritrea has used this border tension with Ethiopia as an excuse for why Isaias is governing with an iron rule. And Eritrean activists and members of the Eritrean diaspora who have been exiled because of this authoritarian practices were hoping that this was also going to lead to opening in Eritrea. But what we see is dashed hopes in Eritrea and dashed hopes in Ethiopia, because nothing has actually come of that peace deal. But I don't want to downplay that, initially people were able to visit their families across the border for the first time in decades, that there was a lot of jubilation, just the way, a lot of Ethiopians also celebrated. But now things just look dire.
And finally, if you could talk to us on how you see the future in the country and also where people can get accurate information as well on what's going on.
It's really, Ethiopia is in a very difficult spot, because as I said, the people, the dominated majority, the historically silenced groups of people who've been, resisting and trying to change things are really feeling demoralized. On top of that, the loss of someone like Haçalu, who represented a peaceful future, who represented a future in which people lived in dignity on their lands, that has been a huge blow. And to make matters worse, the kinds of policies that are, practices that are being put in place, this return to authoritarianism, the silencing of any voice that speaks to those grassroots demands, tells me that we're really in trouble. If things do not change, if these grassroots demands are not heeded, if people are not involved, engaged in the process, in the process of changing these fundamental injustices, the systemic injustices, I am worried that we're going back to either a complete dictatorship or a situation of war. And both are going to be horrible because Ethiopia's people have already been through hell and back, not just since conquest, but the last 30 years of EBRDF rule have been quite violent. They've dispossessed mass groups of people. With Abiy, people were really hoping that we're entering a space in Ethiopian history where things are resolved peacefully, where historically silenced voices are heard, and that's not what's happening. So it's very concerning.
And where can people get accurate information on the current situation in the country?
Well, that's a very tricky one, because there a lot of what is being written about in Ethiopia is coming largely out of the West. Part of it is that the media landscape in Ethiopia is dominated by the government and independent voices have been prevented from airing. I'm really struggling, but a place like Addis Standard, it's a magazine that still operates in Ethiopia. A place like Oromo Advocacy Alliance, our website, it has information sort of about what the grassroots is up to, what their demands are.
And I guess there's also some other media like Al Jazeera, I guess, who...
Yes.
They also, in terms of the outside, the Ethiopian landscape, in terms of the outside media, yes. It seems like they've been covering it a bit more and more broadly. Any other closing thoughts you had?
I was hoping we'll get into this a bit, but one thing I just wanted to say, I think, is this idea of an independent Ethiopia that a lot of Africans hold on to is really preventing them from seeing what is going on in this country, and that it's similar to a lot of the grassroots struggles of other African peoples. And I just want to say that this narrative, this dominant narrative that people hold on to about Ethiopia is really, you know, it's deadly for Oromos and others. Millions are being killed over it. And I think other Africans should think twice about buying into it, buying into this narrative that leads to further dispossession of Oromo peasants and others. And really, I think they need to think about the question, does it matter, you know, whether the person who conquered you is white or black? Because that's really the only difference between what the Oromo are facing and what Africans have faced with the colonial state.
On that note, Ayantu Ayana, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you.
That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist, Moise Mutale, Africa World Now Project media correspondent, Funda Ngunda, senior research, content contributor, and production director, Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior researcher and content contributor and production associate, Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, technology advisor is Byron Gray of GrayWorks Technology, and creative director is Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcasting service of Winston-Salem State University. Shows are archived weekly on SoundCloud. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent. So